Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on Monday morning, and by the way, it's a glorious Monday morning. We normally begin our show reading a poem called America is a Gun, but on occasion we filter in either political limericks or a poem by Lynn Ekdahl. And Lynn's husband is Mel Goodman. Mel Goodman is a former CIA operative. He teaches at Johns Hopkins. We have him on a lot to talk about international affairs. And Lynn wrote this interesting poem, and I thought I would share it with you. It's entitled, Dear Nancy Pelosi. Dear Nancy Pelosi, come back to the States. We don't need the chaos that your travel creates. Although you have constituents of various sorts, you shouldn't pay visits to hot-button ports. Your behavior's indulgent, short-sighted, unwise. From a pro such as you, it's a total surprise. Your trip to Taiwan, made when tensions were high, undermine U.S. interests. So the question is, why? Why thumb your nose at a fellow like Xi, just itching to prove he's the top of the tree? Why give him more fodder, more reason, a pretext to fire his rockets to show that he's vexed? Xi wants a third term as the party's Gen Sec. You've helped him to get there, so I suspect. Dear Nancy Pelosi, I've been a fan. What prompted this visit to old Yerevan? While the U.S. is trying to put out the flames, you go off and endorse the Armenian claims. While you're acting foolish, Joe Biden looks weak, unable to curb your vainglorious streak. Why do you do it? What prompted this goading? Did you promise to do this while blothily emoting? Having said you would do it, did you have to go on, no matter the harm you're putting upon your president and his foreign policy team? Or is this just the result of some petulant dream? Dear Nancy Pelosi, please come back and stay home. Abandon your dreams and your penchant to Rome. Attend to your mission, the work you do best. Let Joe Biden and his team attend to the rest. And of course, this is so interesting because I saw a story. It turns out to be, I think, just a rumor coming out of India that there was a coup in China and Xi was deposed. I've only seen it in the Indian press. It was only, I think, a rumor, but a very interesting rumor and one that terrified me because my daughter, who's been living in China now for the last almost 8 years, is planning on coming home on October 9th with the granddaughter I've never met. And if it turned out that there was a coup, she would have to postpone that trip. So joining us, as he does on many occasions, is Dave Leventhal. Dave Leventhal, I have known since he was working for the Eagle Tribune in Massachusetts. He's worked for many, many organizations. He is now based in Washington, D.C. and oversees insiders, political investigations and enterprise reporting, and writes about the nexus between politics, policy and power in the nation's capital. He's prolific. He's been everywhere and rose up the food chain no matter where he landed. So let me welcome Dave to the program.
Thank you very much, Arnie, and I'm going to have to like hire you to give that introduction to I don't know my family or something like that.
I'm so proud of you. You have no idea. Anyway, we've been following Dave no matter where he landed, whether it was Texas, whether it was the Center for Public Integrity. We would always find Dave because he always wrote about stuff that was near and dear to my head and my heart. You wrote to me about the series that you have now started, which I think is so important, everyone. It's entitled Red, White, and Gray, How America's Gerontocracy is Weakening Democracy. And the timing of it couldn't be better. Of course, we're looking at the oldest president, Joe Biden. We're looking at Donald Trump thinking about running again. And one of the stats that came out was that the age gap between the government and the governed is wider than ever. And I think that that's really important, but here's the nugget. Nearly one in four members of Congress are in their 70s or 80s, a level never before seen in US history. So I wanted to talk about this, Dave, in part because it's personal to my entrance into political life. Back in 1984, I won my first election to the New Hampshire legislature. I was pregnant as I was running. I gave birth literally probably less than a week before the election. And I showed up in the New Hampshire House with my daughter, Kirsten, and I breastfed on the floor of the legislature as well as in committee. And because I was pregnant and having a new baby, the minority leader was not sure she liked me. And she thought she would put me someplace safe where I wouldn't have a lot of work to do, okay? And she assigned me to this committee called State Institutions. And State Institutions, at the time I was assigned to it, was the oldest committee in the New Hampshire House The average age with me on it, and I was barely 30, was about 73. Okay, so you can just imagine. And but it turned out that something happened that she was not prepared for, and that this committee that had only gotten maybe 7 pieces of legislation in 2 years suddenly was redefined by the majority leader and was now called State Institutions and Housing. And housing was a huge issue in the mid 1980s in New Hampshire. So we went from like 4 or 5 bills to like 47 bills. Well, imagine a committee that, you have to prop up half the people and make sure that they were still breathing, okay? And then suddenly I am like the youngest person. I finished law school. I was articulate. I was smart. I actually had been a housing advocate. And the chairwoman of the committee, who also happened to be the chairman of the Republican Party, was gone a lot. And in the end, she had no choice but to assign most of the legislation to me because she knew I was awake and alert and participatory. That was the sign of what happened when you have an older legislature. It's not that they're not smart, it's not that they don't have experience, but their experience is so old. It's from a different time. Half the time, it's not their fault, but after, 2 or 3 hours of hearings, they start to fall asleep. You know what goes on. So as I'm thinking about your piece, I remember saying about the New Hampshire legislature, David, that it was made up of three groups: the rich, the retired, and the remunerated. And to a large extent, when you look at this new sort of this aging demographic, they are really defined by rich, retired, and remunerated because they're so much older. They have a lot of wealth. They have huge war chests for their next campaign. They're so familiar because they've been there forever because we don't have term limits. And yet, when you realize the life they've lived versus the life that, people under the age of 35 are living, it is such a different world.
And Arnie, you laid it out. here in Washington, D.C., in Congress, it will come as no surprise to anyone that Congress, for example, is old. It's always been the case. And it's always been the case that members of Congress serving, on average, are significantly older than the population. So the leaders are much older than those who are being led. But our Red, White, and Gray Project has discovered that there are a number of different sort of new marks that have been hit, superlatives that we can cite that indicate that this is indeed the oldest Congress that has ever served the United States, that the gap between those who are serving in Congress and those who are being served is wider than it's ever been. And you just look on the Democratic side of the ledger, for example,
Nancy
the three.
Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi. Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry.
No, well, Nancy Pelosi, but also Steny Hoyer and James Clyburn, the three top Democrats on the House side, are in their 80s. And it definitely raises the question, and this is part and parcel of our Red, White, and Gray project, is what happens when the priorities of those who are in their 80s and who have been in politics for, in some cases, 40, 50 years or beyond, are colliding with and sometimes clashing with the priorities of people who may be in their 20s or their 30s or their 40s. That could be around a whole variety of issues, which we explore, including technology and civil rights, energy, and perhaps most notably, the environment. And the answer, Arnie, in a sentence, is that oftentimes there is a great deal of tension between the priorities of those who have been in government for a very, very long period of time and those who would like to have power. And that the dynamics, too, are such where you have activists, and this is true for both Democrats and Republicans, too.
Right.
We've talked to many of them, that the those who would love to have an opportunity to lead, love to have an opportunity to be in a position of power, to affect the priorities, to affect the policies of the country. They're being blocked by those who want to retain that power and who aren't going to give it up, no matter what their age or how many years that they've served. So there's definitely a generational, I think war would be an overstatement, but a battle going on in government writ large and within the Democratic and the Republican parties for this. And you see this perhaps even more on the Democratic side because of issues such as, say, the Green New Deal or student loan debt and various others that have come to the fore
just over the past year and a half or so, where there's been a lot of action and there's been a lot of tension. And sometimes the younger folks get what they want, and other times they get left on the outside looking in.
But it's not what younger folks get what they want, it's what they live. Can I stop you? Don't use the word want. It's how they live. Mm-hmm. If you live and you can't find a rental place because there's no affordable housing, it's how you live. If you can't go to college without, you know, bearing $40,000 to $50,000 to $80,000 worth of debt, it's about your future and your opportunity. If you are living in California and the heat index goes to 114 degrees, it's how you live and it's your future. And it's not, again, wanting is a choice. Living, you don't have a choice. I hate to break it to you. It's just, it's what circumstances have handed to you. And that's what sort of terrifies me. I always say to legislators, you are a public servant, not a permanent servant. A public servant. They both begin with P, but permanent is not what was ever envisioned. You know that, and I know that. And as I was reading your pieces, you know who kept going through my head? Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, if there's ever been a screaming reason for term limits, that she couldn't, and she so loved the court. She so loved justice. She so wanted to protect these vulnerable communities. But by not recognizing, acknowledging her cancer, her imminent death, the fact that she was frail, that she, of all people, couldn't even admit it to herself. Imagine how those 70 and 80-year-old legislators or congresspeople are.
Arnie, I must stop you to say, since this segment will be airing on Tuesday, that everyone should go read a story that we have published this morning, the day that this is being aired, because we tackle that issue head on, not only at the Supreme Court level, but at the federal court level. And I think people will read this particular story and be not only surprised, but shocked, and potentially have, to use a colloquialism, they're mind blown as a result of what we found.
So Dave, that's why I called you. We're on the same page. We see the same stories. And again, this is where it really sort of terrifies me. But as we're looking at some of these numbers, I mean, the numbers are shocking, okay? Almost 50% of Americans are under 40, but only 5% of members of Congress are. Now, here's the interesting thing, Dave, because we keep talking about the aging demographic. All right. We know that we don't still have enough young people and enough worker bees. And yet, despite that, we're looking at a significant portion of the population that has no sense of representation. They can't see it themselves there. They don't have people that have that experience there. And as you've been sort of looking at this, you know, red, white and gray, what do you think are sort of the drivers of this? It's not only people that don't want to leave, and you can understand it. They love their job. I mean, I love the New Hampshire legislature, and I earned $100 a year, and I didn't want to leave. I mean, how dumb am I? But they are surrounded by sort of people that keep them in this wonderful cocoon. They tell them when to wake up. They tell them when to go to sleep. They hand them their briefcase. They tell them what to talk about. You know that. There's this wonderful world that they're living in that they can't imagine in some ways learning how to drive themselves or figure out how to wake up. But at the same time, what did you see from talking to people about what could change this? Because unfortunately, it may be older, it may be our reality, but given all the dramatic changes happening on the planet, from a pandemic, from the climate crisis, from Putin, from Xi, from remanufacturing, from looking at alternative energy, how do we change this? They're not going to go willingly.
I'll answer your question directly in 20 seconds. But I want to say this first, is that this project was never in any way intended to be something that would smack of ageism or even suggest that those who are in their 60s, 70s, 80s or beyond can't make massive contributions to the discourse in society, to the government that they serve. Yet that's not the point of this. It's looking at really the overall trend and to a government that has become, in a very real way, a gerontocracy, and what the implications of that are, given the choices that we have as a country to make and the issues that we're grappling with at this very moment. Now to your question, Arnie, what are the drivers here? Well, there's several. First of all, money is a huge driver. When you're an incumbent, you win, if you're in the House, about 85 to 90% of the time. So if you're in office, it's very difficult to get you out, no matter what. And money factors in because you have the ability to fundraise to a great degree. You have consolidated power. You have made lots and lots of friends who might be lobbyists or special interests or others who will keep you there and will help you in your time of need. And there's that relationship that very much exists in Washington. Before Donald Trump, we called it the swamp. And in a different context, we can still call that now. But it's very real. You know, there's a relationship that exists once you get in Congress with many members of Congress. Gerrymandering and redistricting is also an issue, too. And that reinforces, especially those who are already entrenched, their entrenchedness. And that will, mainly serve to keep those who are in a favorable district in that favorable district, or even a more favorable district. Of course, exceptions to the rules, but we're talking about the overall trend again. And we have a fascinating story today on Monday when we're recording this that talks about two other factors, the notion of term limits, first of all, and the notion of age limits, and whether either of those two ideas would ever factor into politics going forward. This is not pie in the sky stuff, Arnie, in the sense that term limits are, we have them for the presidency of the United States. We have them in state legislatures all over the country. We have them for judges in certain states as well, but it's not something that Congress is willing to entertain at this point. And then the real provocative question is age. Should there be an age limit for an elected official? Now, we have age limits for example, Supreme Court judges at the state level in many states around the country. We have them for military generals and admirals. We have them for pilots. And there are other jobs too where basically, it's been deemed by those who oversee those types of jobs, those types of careers, that they want to ensure that somebody is going to have the mental acuity and physical ability to go and do that job and do it well and execute the duties at a very high level, which is why they have those age limits. Very controversial, but nevertheless, we're not shying away from tackling these topics in what we hope is going to be a very clear-eyed and a very fair way. And we got lots of responses. We have talked to quite literally dozens of members of Congress, current and former. We have talked to aides. We have talked to experts. We have talked to medical personnel. And I think your listeners will find this to be a fascinating read, not because of what we've done, but because of what the people we've talked to are saying. Mm-hmm. And some of the people who are actually in favor of term limits and even age limits are those not who are 25 or 30 or 35, but those who are 75 or 80 or 85 saying, no, so look, we need to have a new generation.
So a couple of things as I'm listening to you. First of all, I have a question about age limits, but I don't have a question anymore about term limits. And term limits would make age limits moot. And the reason I say that, I don't, if you run at age 60, go for it, honey bun. If you think that you'll be competent for the next 12 years and you're like amazing at 60, but the term limits then at least gives you an idea that it ends. And it, you know, you may end prematurely because you might die in office, or you may end because you may have a stroke, but term limits in some ways is kind of almost like age neutral in a lot of ways, which I think is a really good thing. And the other reason why I like term limits is, for example, I know you mentioned you're going to be talking about the courts in the article today at Red, White, and Gray at insider.com. And one of the reasons is, for example, I'm looking at the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court. They keep choosing people younger and younger. Pretty soon they'll choose a judge who's in utero. I mean, let's be honest here. They want to be able to control for in perpetuity. That's really what this is about. They want someone that will be on the bench for 40 years. That's immoral. That is wrong. And the way to address that is if you did term limits, then guess what? You could pick a seasoned justice in their early 60s who had served for 12 years and maybe leave at 75. But therefore, you wouldn't have this need to go to 40, 38, 37. Oh, my God. I mean, again, that's the other problem with the age limit thing, is that age limit is a bad thing because it then drives you sometimes into younger people, not because you're looking for youth and you want to bring in the next generation. You're just looking for someone that you can sort of permanently place for the next 40 years. And that sucks, Dave.
Well, actually, that's a very fascinating take on what we've talked to plenty of people about, is that especially with Donald Trump, his going forward and in naming, for example, you know, Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, younger. These are not people in their 60s or 70s, you know, 40s and 50s. Yeah. And by doing so, in essence, it's sort of a long-term investment in the gerontocracy, if you will, in the sense that they're being appointed today. And you know, you could say this with Joe Biden, with you know, Ketanji Brown Jackson as well. So, you know, you are ensuring, barring somebody having ill health or deciding to resign for another reason, that they are going to be there, not in just 2022 or 2032, but 2042, 2052, 2062. It could be 40 years from now, and we will still be talking in contemporary terms about people who have been there for upwards of half a century. So, you know, this is not to advocate for or against term limits or age limits or anything else, quite the contrary. But what we're trying to show is that there are very real world implications to this, and ones that extend out in this particular case, Arnie, into the second half of the current century that we're in, when we're still talking about the 20th century as if it happened to go yesterday.
And I mean, people kept asking me to run, and I'm going to be 69 on Saturday. And I'm like, I'm not going to run.
Happy birthday.
Oh, shut up. Anyway, so I'm like, I'm like, I want to pass the torch. And one of the reasons is, it's not only about the climate crisis. It's not only about student debt, you know, which I didn't have the same experience, although I see it through my children. But for example, one of the articles that you write about is tech policy. I mean, think about technology and how we're not seeing it change. We're seeing it sprint. And young people who, you know, who've been texting since they were four have a different relationship with technology than someone who got their first iPhone at 72, you know, and needs to be. And but yet, to a large extent, you know why they want older people there? Because the tech community knows that they don't understand it, that they can confuse them, that they can manipulate. So in a lot of ways, this isn't good for technology. This is good for the corporations that control the technology, but you want a sophisticated person involved in doing oversight and regulations and writing laws, someone who truly gets it because they've lived it. And most of those people in their 70s and 80s, sweetheart, they haven't lived it.
In our tech story, Arnie, there's a passage in it, and it's not the headline of the story. It's not the lead of the story, but I think it may be the most important part of the story. And it has to do with this little long forgotten office that was disbanded about not quite 30 years ago in Congress, mm-hmm. that existed for the sole strict purpose of helping educate members of Congress on technological issues. And Newt Gingrich, when he was Speaker of the House, he defunded it. And okay, fine, he defunded it, but it could be funded again. They could bring it back. And it's never been a priority in the next 27 odd years. Come Democrats, come Republicans, nobody has said, well, okay, you know, maybe it would be a good idea for us to, in essence, have an office that is dedicated to increasing the technology IQ for the lawmakers in Congress that are going to be making decisions that oftentimes are going to be worth into the billions of dollars. We just saw that with the CHIPS Plus bill that passed over the summer. Exactly. And do so in a way that's really going to help members of Congress, particularly those who may struggle with the rapid fire changes that are taking place in the world of technology right now, help them make good decisions when ultimately they have to advocate for a bill or advocate against a bill or vote for a bill or vote against it. And that's just simply not something that has been a priority in Congress. And I thought it was very emblematic of the broader situation that something like that is just, you know, it's kind of gotten lost in the wash and forgotten. This was an opportunity to resurface it.
Dave, I want Red, White, and Gray, How America's Gerontocracy is Weakening Democracy, to be read in every college campus in America. Okay? I want every political science major, I want every econ major, I want every tech major, I want them to read this, because this is really, really an important article in so important series in so many ways, in part because if you want young people to get involved, they also need to see each other. And when they only see people who are in their 70s and 80s, it's hard to sort of say, well, you should vote for me. Really? I'm like, you know, so another reason to sort of expand the franchise and to encourage people to exercise the franchise is that they know that they can participate in governing. That's an invitation in, is to see themselves. I mean, I remember running for governor as the first female, you know, nominee in history. And, right. And all these, it wasn't just young girls that were excited. It was also young boys. It was the idea that I was bringing something different into the political setting. And that difference meant that they would be participating as well. So I think people need to quite understand why this is just so, so important. Again, everyone, Dave Leventhal works with Insider.com. They are putting together this fabulous series. I think it's important. Again, I want people to serve as public servants. I loved serving. Let me repeat, I loved serving. But I also knew that I needed to be a public servant, not a permanent servant. And as soon as you create permanence, you change the nature of the relationship between the elected and those that elect them. So again, red, white, and gray, how America's gerontocracy is weakening democracy. We've been chatting with Dave Leventhal. He oversees Insider's political investigations and enterprise reporting and writes about the nexus of politics, policy, and power in the nation's capital. It has been an honor to know you over these decades, and thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you. Many thanks, Ernie.
All right, ciao. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
Lonely nights are out there on the road.
You're listening to Emmy Lou Harris and
Motel ceiling stares you down.
You're on the Soundbeat.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 19.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Monday morning. So I'm looking at the New Republic, and I see a title of an article, and it was entitled, "Is This When Democrats Finally Learn How to Message?" And I'm screaming because if you listen to this radio show for the last 30 years, you would hear me sort of beat this drum over and over again, like, what are you saying? Repeat it. Don't say it once. Does it resonate with people you're talking to? I mean, I'm like going crazy, and I try to train people, but you know, I come from a state that is, if it's Democrat at all, it's sort of purple. And if it's purple, it's sort of, you know, in how do I say this? It's in the pocket of the financial institutions and the real estate institutions, and they don't tend to be edge walkers. And I've been known to be a very progressive edge walker when it comes to politics in New Hampshire. But as I saw this, I really wanted to talk to the author. Michael Sokolov is the author of 5 books, including Drama High, The Incredible True Story of a Brilliant Teacher. Oh, wow. A Struggling Town and the Magic of Theater, which was the inspiration for the NBC primetime series Rise. Since 2001, he's been a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, where he's written about about science, culture, and sociology of sports, as well as politics and a broad range of other topics. And my father and mother are both teachers, so this was like an exciting thing. And my daughter learned to read because of theater. So you need to know that was the invitation in. She had to pursue performance. And since she had reading issues, the way she figured out she needed to learn to read was that was the only way she could get on the stage. So welcome to the program, Michael. And thank you so much for writing this piece at New Republic.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
As I'm reading the headline, I want to share a story with you. I'm going to take you back to 1996. Okay, I'm an old woman. And back in 1996, I was chosen as one of the six Democrats that if they won her congressional seat, would change Congress if she won. Okay, six of us were chosen by the Democratic Party. We were flown to Washington. We attended these high-priced dinners. I mean, we were like cattle, you know, we were being shown off, you know, check their teeth. Anyway, I was a little bit miserable. But then we went in and the Democratic members of Congress were sitting there in a meeting and we were invited in to attend. And they were so also sort of showcasing what we needed to talk about going forward if we were going to run a congressional race. So we got to listen. And finally, I raised my hand and I was called on and they said, yes, Ms. Arneson. I said, you know, I have to tell you something. I'm really jealous of Republicans. And they went, what? And I said, and they said, why? I said, because Republicans have it so simple. They can put their entire agenda on a bumper sticker. And that agenda is one word. And the one word is no. No taxes, no regulations, no public education, frankly, right now when you're looking at what they're doing with vouchers and whatever. You know, I said, and you know what the beauty of the word no is? You don't have to explain it. It ends the sentence. No means that's it. It's wonderful. I mean, you know, it sort of gets you off the policy hook. And they're all looking at me and I said, you know what our problem is? Our problem is that we are about yes. Yes, some taxes. Yes, some regulation. Yes, some environmental protection. And I went through the laundry list. And I said, and as soon as you say the word yes, it gets complicated because you can't fit it on a bumper sticker and you have to explain it. I said, and you know, you just hate explaining it. You're so jealous of Republicans. And you just wish it would just be over. And then you don't take the time to explain it. And then you explain it in ways that nobody understands. And then you never repeat the yes and what it means. And I said, but you know what we forgot to do? We forgot to remind the American people that you don't build a life around no. You build a life around yes. Yes, I love you. Yes, I'll marry you. Yes, I will have children with you. Yes, I'll take this job. Yes, I'll buy this house. And you don't say yes to everyone. And you don't say yes to every job. And you can't afford to say yes to every house. It has to be an informed, nuanced yes. I said, but the way we build lives in America is around the word yes, not around the word no. Why aren't you reminding the American people that that's why the party of the Democrats is a party that's about your future? Because it's like your life. And I'll never forget Nancy Pelosi was sitting behind me. No, not Nancy Pelosi. One of the members of Congress from Connecticut. And she tapped me on the shoulder and she said, "So who the hell are you again?" And that was 1996, Michael. And to this day, it's everything I believe. And I really do believe that we have so much more in common with what Americans dream about, what they want, the safety and security they need, what they want in their streets, what they want in their schools, what they want in their environment. And the fact that they don't connect the dots between what it is they want and the policy prescriptions that we have, to me, is a crime. And yet I saw that in 1996, and now you're writing this in 2022. Is this when Democrats finally learn how to message? Oh my God, my only question to you is it's too late?
Well, I think you hit, Arnie, on all the right points there. And yes is a more complicated message, but it's not an impossible message. And you said connect the dots. And, you know, I think one thing is to remind people what Republicans have said no to, which is virtually everything that makes people's lives livable, whether it's Social Security or clean air and clean water or seat belts. Or, you know, child safety and worker safety. I mean, when you say no to everything, you have a pretty primitive world. And, you know, and so I do think part of it is calling the other side out for Democrats. But But also, yes is certainly much more complicated. And when you say yes, it doesn't always work out, by the way, or it doesn't work out right away. You know, healthcare, you know, what the Republicans, you know, labeled immediately Obamacare, you know, wasn't perfect right away. And it's not perfect now. And the website didn't work. And why would it work right away? It's a big, complicated thing. So you're talking to people who have, you know, in the electorate, who have no patience sometimes, who lack nuance. So in fairness, it is really difficult. And, you know, I talked to people in this piece about how you can message better. And I thought a consultant named Anat Shankar Osorio, I thought she said some of the smartest things. She said, sell the brownie, not the recipe. So sell the outcomes of policy rather than the very complicated policies. And I think that's something that the Democrats struggle with. But on the other hand, Democrats tend to think they're smarter. And by, you know, by the data, by, you know, current standards, you know, Democrats do tend to be more educated. They went to all these elite schools, all this stuff. Well, you ought to be able to figure it out if you're that well educated and that smart. And even now, like the Inflation Reduction Act, like what a ridiculous, awful name. First of all, by the time this election comes up, inflation is not going to be sufficiently reduced. So it opens you up to ridicule. So they make the same mistakes again and again. And you have to say, who the heck named it that?
But you know why they named it? Because of Joe Manchin. Because Joe Manchin kept saying, I'm not going to support anything because it's just going to enhance inflation. So in order to sort of give Joe Manchin, they genuflected on everything. I mean, Joe Manchin has driven so much of this policy, even the frickin' name. You're absolutely right. The name is pathetic. It is pathetic. I don't wake up in the morning going, oh, I'm so grateful for that Inflation Reduction Act. I'm appalled at that. And yet when you realize all the good things in there that were smothered by that title, smothered, nobody knows about it because they only know the title of the Inflation Reduction Act. And so the one thing they connected is, oh, the price of gas is going down. Well, they look at everything else and they're going, but look at the rest of my life. The cost of eggs is $3.38. The cost of, right. You know, it's like, so in a lot of ways, they didn't speak to so much about the job creation and the alternative energy and the investment in remanufacturing, all the things that people want for their kids and for their future. But who knows, it's in there because right there, you're stopped by the title.
It's pretty catastrophically bad. And I think a lot of younger Democrats and a lot of progressive Democrats don't always understand you have to have the votes to win. So that's just a fact. And I, you know, I argue sometimes with my one of my daughters about this, you know, whether it's defund the police or whatever. I mean, language really, really matters. Yes, the Democrats have had to deal with Joe Manchin because otherwise you're nowhere. But I didn't realize what you're saying is you feel they let him name the thing too. I don't. Trust me.
I know they let him name it. I mean, well, that's pathetic. But again, everyone was so afraid of Joe that they ended up trying to figure out how do I craft something so that he will put his signature on it. And in part, listen to what he said: inflation, inflation, inflation. Him and Larry Summers, they should sleep together. I mean, that's all that we ended up hearing about. And to a large extent, I want to talk to people about their lives. I mean, like the Affordable Care Act. You were mentioning the problem with the Affordable Care Act. Well, one of the problems with the Affordable Care Act is that Obama made a mistake. He negotiated with himself, okay? He didn't negotiate with Republicans, he negotiated with himself. So as he was draining a lot of the vitality out of the Affordable Care Act, he never explained to the American people what was in the Affordable Care Act because he kept trying to accommodate Republicans that were never gonna sign on. But you know who wanted to sign on? People who had kids that were still in college that could stay on their parents, you know, healthcare till they were 26. You know who wanted to sign on? People like me who had pre-existing conditions, they wanted to sign on. So instead of talking to the people who would so absolutely passionately benefit, he was either trying to convince Republicans who were never going to do anything. And I think in the end, that hurt us as well. We don't even know who we're selling to. We're not selling to Republicans. We're selling to the American people.
I think you're right. I mean, I think there's often an inability to speak directly to people about their lives.
Yes.
And look, it's a hard thing to do. And, you know, one of the people in the story, a consultant named Anna Greenberg, said, look, we vet all our messages and we want to make sure they're true. And we have lawyers look at it. And the other side just tells
lies,
bleeping lies.
Yeah.
So, but it's not enough to just say, well, we have a more complicated job. I think that Democrats have failed to build on victories. I mean, right now, Republicans, you know, in the polls, you know, trust, people in polls are said to trust Republicans more than Democrats on the economy. There's nothing in the history of the last four, five, six presidencies
exactly
that would back that. I mean, Obama came into office on the heels of a catastrophic recession. You know, the Clinton years were prosperous. People don't know that. I mean, I think that has to be a failure to let them know that. And I think that the way to do that is not necessarily to roll the numbers out, but for people who are old enough to say, how was it really for you in the Obama years? You know, did you have a job? Did you have an income? How was it for you in the Clinton years? Do you remember the Great Recession? Do you see all the money going up, you know, up the ladder to richer people? Do you see right now the deficit actually coming down? And these messages, they're not easy, but they're also not impossible, I don't think, to convey.
You talk about the fact that Democrats are smarter. I'm going to resent that. I don't think we're smarter because I don't think we're practical. And in the end,
better educated. Let's say better educated.
Yeah, better educated. I remember being sort of, they were poo-pooing me because I went to St. Olaf College and Vermont Law School, and I didn't go to Harvard and Yale and Princeton, and I wanted to say, screw you, you know, as if somehow that I wasn't part of the elite. And I'm looking at the elite going, and where has that gotten you? Anyway, so as I'm listening to you, I also think that we have to also sometimes say people are legitimately angry. The Republican base does have some legitimate anger. You know, when you see how the jobs disappeared in the 1970s and 1980s, and they saw that suddenly their wife had to go to work. It's so interesting. I don't know if you've ever thought about this, Michael, but think about it. The 1970s was the feminist movement. You know, we were equal pay for equal work. We were going to come out. We want to make sure that we're in the boardroom. We're going to work with men. And I'm thinking, this is the perfect thing, because just as the jobs that were paying $20 and $25 an hour disappeared, and they were replaced by jobs that paid $12 and $13 an hour, guess what? Wifey needed to work, because in order to pay the mortgage, you needed two incomes, not one. So we thought this was feminism. No, it was just basic math. I mean, I hate to break it to you, that's really what it was. And then you go into the 1990s, and I'm going, you know what the problem is? Now we need a menage a trois. Now you need to bring, you know, your 18-year-old into the mix in order to make sure you can pay for the affordable housing. So in a lot of ways, I think we have to also legitimize people's anger. It is legitimate. And you can talk about what we are going to do, but what we have to recognize is, what are they experiencing? And again, that I think is something that's sometimes hard, because we see them as just angry white men, but there's a piece of that angry white male that actually is very true. And then the question becomes, so how do we speak to that anger, but then also say, but what the Republicans are offering you doesn't address your anger. It massages it, it inflames it, but guess what it doesn't do? It doesn't fix it, Michael.
You know, I agree with everything you said, and you're speaking strictly on economic terms, and that's really important. The current appeal of the conservative movement is well beyond that. It's appealing to a lot of people whose lives are fine. I just did some reporting in Pennsylvania just in the last week or two. I write a lot about Pennsylvania, where I'm from. There's lots of people whose lives are just fine economically, and they feel culturally displaced. And they don't feel culturally displaced for reasons that we really want to address, because they feel culturally displaced because it's not a white nation anymore. And they don't want to hear things about transgender people, and they really don't want to hear about climate change. And they just don't want to be bothered by some things that are very important. So I think that's a much more difficult thing to message around, because it's very real. And, you know, the so-called white working class, you know, the perception is, well, that can be addressed just by somehow getting people back their, you know, $25 an hour jobs or $30 an hour, or getting Amazon warehouse jobs to pay that and to have better working conditions. And, you know, I don't even know that that's the answer, because Republicans have become very good at taking credit for things that they vote against.
I know.
So
the hypocrisy is just remarkable.
Yeah. So I don't know the answer to that second part. I mean, a lot of it is just loss of status and loss of privilege. I just don't know the answer for that. I'm not sure about the messaging for that, except, you know, to direct it at people who feel differently, and certainly on things like the right, like the abortion issue, you know, to say to women and to say to men, you know, this is a loss of freedom. This is an American value. And, you know, whether it's abortion or the right to read what you want or the right to love who you want, you know, those can be put in probably better terms. Right. But how to message to people who are racist, or how to message to people who are completely unhinged from reality? I don't have an answer for that. I don't know that anybody does.
I'm not worried about them, because the people that are unhinged from reality, we will never get. They're in a cult.
But there's a lot of them.
There's a lot of them. But if I spend my time on that 30%, then I will not be focusing on the other 70%. And one of the things that I think about, and after reading your article, and you needed to know something, I cover our biggest audience is like Houston, Texas. Okay, that's our biggest audience. Wow. And so I'm looking at this young Hispanic woman who just won a Republican seat. Okay, and she won in a special election. She'll be running again. And I looked at her messaging, because this is a story about, you know, is this when Democrats finally learn how to message? Here is her message, and this is what I posted on my Facebook page, Michael. After reading your article and reading about her, this was her message to her base, her Hispanic base that historically had always voted Democrat, and then suddenly they embraced her. Her message was three words: God, family, country. Okay, those are her three words. So here's my question to you, Michael. What's our three words?
Well, first of all, when you say our three, so I grew up in newspapers in Philadelphia, and huh? You know, I am still a fairly traditional journalist, although as a magazine writer and book author, I'm allowed to have my feelings, but I do respond a little bit about our message. So yeah.
What is the
Democrats' message?
Yeah.
The Democrats' message is freedom, freedom, freedom. That's the message. The message is, you know, the other side is engaging in overreach, which is what the Republicans used to say. Right. You know, we want to be free to live as Americans. We want freedom over our medical choices, over our bodily choices, freedom to love who we want, freedom to read what we want, freedom for our children and our grandchildren to live on a planet that is livable. Everything is freedom. Freedom for our future, freedom for our planet's future. There's nothing that's important to people that cannot be framed as freedom, even if it's a stretch. I mean, you know, you talked in the beginning about Republicans just keep on saying the same thing. Democrats get bored with that because they want to be clever. Stretch freedom every single way you can and make it clear to the other side that all of these things really are infringements on freedom. I mean, the Republicans right now are very successful at talking about, you know, you need to be, you know, you need to know what your children are being taught in school. But that's really a way of constricting what they learn. We want our kids to be free to read books and free to explore science and free to do all these things without politicians coming and putting their foot on the scale and saying, no, 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 no. Kids are really smart. Like, leave them free to figure it out.
Well, someone said the other day that, you know, they're banning books and they don't realize that they got all those books on their iPhone.
Yeah. Well, you know, as an author.
It's so
funny. As an author, I would love one of my books to be banned. There's nothing better for sales.
Oh, my God. Exactly. As I'm listening to you, it's so interesting because I think the Republicans think they own that word freedom. Because
they have.
They've taken over liberty.
They have. I mean, what Democrats need to do is take it back.
Well, and they also talk, and they talk about, here's the interesting thing. I want to challenge them on religious liberty. They use that all the time. And I've been telling people this for 20 years. The U.S. has more places of worship per person than any country in the world. That's the definition of religious liberty. That is the celebration. You come here to find your God. You come here to, like, you know, to find your faith. You come here, and we even have proof because we have those numbers. That's what we're, so I want to use the religious liberty word and stick it to them, because they think they own it and they're defining it as white Christian evangelicalism. And I'm going to say, really, this is what religious liberty means. It's that freedom that you were talking about. And I think because they've used that word, we run away from it. And that's why I asked that question about God, family, and country, because I really do see us as a place of faith. Whatever that faith is, find it. I do see family. I see families. Families, they come in all kinds. Single moms, you know, heterosexual families, homosexual families, but people that take care of each other in a family setting. You know, that's absolutely true. And country, you know, I want to know, when did you enlist? I want to know, when did you join AmeriCorps? I want to know, when did you act as a public servant? I've done all of those things, you know? Right. So, I mean, that's love of country. And I think if we take those words, I would be a Democrat and I would grab every one of her words and I would interpret them.
Right.
And say,
yeah, I think that's a great way. That's a great way of putting it. I'll tell you a really quick story about religious freedom. A couple of years ago, I sat next to an older man on a plane who was coming back from an evangelical conference. He told me about all the churches he had opened. And, you know, like six of them, he was an older man. I helped him. He was a nice man. I put his suitcase up above for him. And he started talking about Trump and Republicans. And, you know, he wanted religious, you know, Trump was going to give religious freedom. I said, you open six churches. You can pray anytime you want. You can pray to any God you want. What freedom of religion are you lacking? But that, you know, the freedom of religion that people want and the public displays of religion really come with a lack of freedom for people who don't want to worship in the same way as one of the mounts do usually, or want to live as, you know, with whom they want to love or what they want to read, any of those things.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'll end this segment, but I attended an organic dinner, and there was, like, you know, 50 years of NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farmers Association, whatever. And I was telling someone the other day that after I left, and I was listening to them talk about their relationship to the earth and their relationship to community and the kinds of foods they wanted to protect and what they wanted to do with the environment, I said, you know, I realized what organic farmers are. They want to make their heaven here. And the reason I want to say that is that I don't care what your faith is, but the idea of making your heaven here means that you're a steward of the environment. I'm going to use those biblical words. I want to use the word of heaven, but I want to explain heaven through an environmental lens. I want to explain heaven through an investment in young people and public education and making it possible for them to achieve their dream. And again, they own those terms too. And part of what I think we have to do is we have to take them back. Because we have to celebrate them and not be afraid of them. And, you know, everyone used to kid me when I was running for governor in Congress that it was Arnie the preacher, because Arnie would get up there and tell stories and Arnie would talk about these things. And it was like, it's okay. It's okay. Don't run away from those. You know, I may have lost the election, Michael, but I got more votes than any Democrat in history in 1992 when I lost my election. You know, I mean, people need to understand, instead of looking at what I accomplished, they just looked at the loss. Right. What the Republicans do is they look at what they have accomplished. Democrats have to rethink elections as well. The title of his piece at The New Republic, which I recommend everyone read, in fact, I sent it to two Congress people just to let you know, is "This When Democrats Finally Learn How to Message. Republicans have been running circles around Democrats for decades, but finally the right has handed them a potent weapon. Will they recognize it and use it?" And actually the most potent weapon they handed us was Dobbs. So thank you so much for doing this, Michael. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
It was a pleasure. Yes, yes, yes. Abortion. Women, rise up. Not only will you protect yourselves, but you'll protect your democracy. That's all I have to say. And on that note, this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You better-